argument for the new year, 98-3634 FT, Sandra L. Scherf, Bowling, Inc., and is it Mr. Beitel? Bechtel, arguing for Bowling, Inc., counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Scott Bechtel, and I represent Bowling, Inc., the defendant, respondent, petitioner in this case. I will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And in my first 25 minutes, I intend to cover the standard of review, and I will be also urging the reversal of the Court of Appeals decision and a return to the trial court's decision to deny Shirk's default judgment motion. And there's two reasons for this urgence. Number first, Bowling, Inc. has met the extraordinary circumstances standard for relief from default judgment, and that's a term I'll be using throughout this morning, extraordinary circumstances. And then the alternative, I think Bowling, Inc. has met the more narrow excusable neglect standard that's used both for the enlargement of time to file an answer and for the vacating a default judgment that has been entered. In terms of the standard of review, I've outlined it in the brief. I believe that we are here on a de novo matter, in that what we're attempting to do this morning is to define the appropriate legal standard by which the trial court should decide a motion for default judgment. What standard should the trial courts use when they're trying to decide whether or not to grant or deny a default judgment motion? And I cite the J.L. Phillips case for that proposition. Now, secondly, and this is throughout my brief, we must remember that the trial court does exercise discretion when it works in this area, and there is an abuse of discretion standard that I believe the reviewing court should afford the trial court when it is struggling with deciding whether or not to grant or deny a motion for default judgment. This trial court, in our case, did address the facts and circumstances resulting in Bowling, Inc. not filing what the trial court concluded was not a timely answer. And it also addressed the default judgment issues and found that there would be a reopener motion anyway, which I promise you there would have been. And that
Bowling, sure to speak up, counsel. I'm having difficulty.
I'm sorry. And that Bowling could meet the standards of the reopener statute. That's the term that Judge Kahn used, if you noticed in the transcript. He referred to it as the reopener statute. And he also referred to all the reopener standards within that statute. He was referring to 80607. The court noted that there was a confusing summons that was used in this case, and that the lawyers had been negotiating and these issues had been joined at the time that the complaint was filed in the circuit court. And Judge Kahn, or the trial court, also noted that there was a meritorious defense which had been pled in the answer by Bowling, Inc., and also noted then the general public policy notion disfavoring default judgments and favoring instead allowing parties to decide the cases on their merits and not be subject to what the judge called legal traps.
Counsel, can I ask, well, I have a question on just your reference in your brief and reference to statute 18166, which was referenced in the summons. In other words, this is the obscure statute.
That is the...
Now, just as I understand this, the statute says that if the DFI is served and the pleadings directed an answer within 20 days, I wanted to know, are we, when you refer to this as an obscure statute, or one, maybe it's not frequently used, but it is there, so you would know that it, anything that's served under 18166.2 puts you on notice as far as what's going to happen. So is there an injustice by the use of the statute or what?
Well, I think it is an obscure statute in the sense that it is seldom used, and there's an affidavit that was before trial court to that effect.
What qualifies for an obscure statute? What is it? It's just not used a lot?
It's not used a lot. It also does not parallel another statute that is used sometimes for substituted service upon an insurance company in the state of Wisconsin. And if you analyze 181 versus the insurance statute, the site I don't have right at my fingertips, there's a great difference between those statutes. 181, Justice Wilcox, has been repealed. By the way, it was repealed literally about 2 weeks after the motion hearing was heard in this case. So obviously, the legislature thought that it would make sense just for everyone to be subject to the same service standards, namely 45 days. They also repealed 18166 to provide that personal service could be affected upon a foreign non-stock corporation, which is what Bulling Inc. status was now. So I think it was an obscure statute, and it's also a repealed statute. In terms of the obscurity, the affidavits do indicate one of my partners called over to the DFI. They were not, he talked to two different lawyers. They weren't familiar with the use of the statute and did acknowledge that a summons had come in to them. I've noted in the brief also that the statute provides that an endorsed copy was sent back to Ms. Shirk's counsel. We did not receive an endorsed copy of that summons and complaint. That also would have put Bowling Inc. on notice that this substituted service method had been used. So the summons was faulty in that it just indicated and it was sent to Bowling Inc. Didn't indicate on the summons form that we had anything other than 20 days from Bowling Inc.'s receipt of the summons in which to respond. And the summons form and the other paperwork didn't indicate through an endorsed copy, similar to an authenticated copy that the circuit courts use, so that a party understands that there has been a filing and the time is told then for them to begin to prepare their answer.
Counsel, one of the things that I was thinking about in this case is, why didn't you pursue arguments under 801.15.2a, the extension of time to file, as opposed to 806.07?
Well, that's a fair question, and I've struggled with it myself, but I may be wrong, but I'll go to my grave believing that we did not have to file an answer until 20 days from receipt of the summons, because that's what the summons told us to do. So for me to file an 801.15 enlargement of time motion, I think would have been an admission or concession that the summons and the process had been properly followed. And I was not willing to concede that point.
But yet you stand here and tell us what the issues are. You, although you make some argument in your brief regarding statutory construction of 181, that certainly doesn't appear to be the issue of moment. That's not really what you folks are here discussing. Now, maybe it's because it's repealed, but that doesn't make any difference for your case. You know, so, I mean, you're talking about an erroneous exercise of discretion. You're talking about excusable neglect. You're talking about extraordinary circumstances. You're not saying, now, court, take a look at 181, and so...
Well,
so I repeat my, you know, if you're not really arguing that, then why aren't you posturing this case that way? Is there any other reason?
There's no other reason. I just did not feel that we were late in filing the answer because of the way the summons was presented to my client. And he moved for it, or Ms. Shirk moved for a default judgment and responded to the default judgment.
Let me try this. Assuming that you are late.
Okay.
Is this a 801.15.2a case or a preemptive 806.07?
It could be either one. That's what the court has said before.
Which of the two is the better way to go?
I would think that because we never filed a motion to enlarge time under 801.15, we shouldn't be addressing that statute.
But didn't the trial court, I think it's on page 15 of the appendix, say, I will accept the answer?
Yes. Which had previously been filed. So it wasn't as if I had to move for an enlargement of time. It's
So it wasn't as though, I didn't hear you. So it wasn't as though?
I didn't move for an enlargement of time at that point because the answer had already been filed. So to answer your question, I think we really should focus on the 806.07 standards. We did have a motion for default judgment, which was before the trial court, and that's what the parties were arguing about. I say it doesn't matter that much because I'm aware of the case law that suggests that an 801.15 excusable neglect standard matches the excusable neglect standard used under 806.07.1a. Now, again, I'm arguing, I think I meet that standard, the excusable neglect under 1A of 80607. I also think I meet the standard under 80607-1H, which is the extraordinary circumstances. And I think this is more of an extraordinary circumstances case because we had this unusual statute, seldom used. It's now been repealed. After all, technically, Justice Bradley, if we were to concur or to agree that the answer was late, technically, we were late by about 4 days, I believe. So when you look at the overall counterbalancing that has to occur in terms of the interest of judgment, or the disfavorment of default judgment motions being granted, I think we have a fairly simple, straightforward case. Let's get to the merits, and that's what the trial court did.
Why do you want to go back to the trial court? Walk me through the remand. What would we remand for?
Well, we've argued the remand in the alternative, Justice Abramson. I think this court can settle this case once and for all, because I think there's enough in the decision, the fact-finding, and the decision of the trial court, and I think there's enough in the factual record for this court to draw inferences from that record to decide, yes, this meets the 80607 standards, and it was appropriate for the trial court to deny the default judgment. I've argued the remand in the alternative.
Appropriate to grant the summary judgment?
I'm sorry?
You won the summary judgment.
Well, yes. I mean, ultimately, if one of the issues is a meritorious defense, I think that's a pretty good example that we have a meritorious defense.
That's why I want you to walk me through this. So your first line, as I understand it, is this court can say that no default judgment should have been granted, or you can reopen that default.
The denial was appropriate, yes.
That's right. So yeah. The trial court denial was appropriate. The other alternative is that it goes back to the trial court for the trial court to make a decision on the default judgment based on the standard we set up.
The standard that you set up, clarify whatever words we want to put to it, and if this court believes that the trial court did not make the findings that it should have, or that there's not enough in the factual record to draw the inferences that you all.
Exercise the discretion rather than we exercise the discretion, just as in Hedke, we sent it back.
Right. And I noticed, and I don't have that case right in front of me. I think it may have been the MLB case.
Okay.
This court in 1982 or 84 did that very exercise, where you weren't quite sure by looking at the record whether or not the trial court had exercised its discretion properly. You didn't just take that decision away from the trial court. You sent it back with some instruction for the trial court. I think this trial court did what it was supposed to.
But even if we do that independently, doesn't the case still go back to the Court of Appeals on the summary judgment appeal?
I think that would be appropriate, yes, because the Court of Appeals, there were three issues that Ms. Shirk had filed on the summary judgment, and two of those issues were not raised or gotten to by the Court of Appeals. So I suppose it does, fairness to Ms. Shirk.
That's why I wanted to play it out. If we remanded to the trial court to determine whether or not default judgment should be given, and if they say it should not be given, that still leaves open the issue that had already gone before the Court of Appeals. So you've got two courts operating here.
I think now that you've asked those questions, that's correct. One might ask why the Court of Appeals didn't go ahead and decide the other two issues. That's its discretion, I suppose, and it felt that it
didn't
need to.
Well, because courts generally don't decide issues that are not determinative. They go on to the next case.
Right.
Problem is, if there's a reversal, it has to go back, and neither one of you briefed the summary judgment issue, nor raised it on review. That's fine.
Not before this court, correct.
I'm just raising that as an issue.
Right. Okay. But those issues were briefed, Justice Abramson, at the Court of Appeals level.
I understand.
Yeah. So what is the trial court to do when it's faced with a motion for a default judgment based on an untimely answer? First, the court is required to consider 80602, which is the statute that directs the trial court as to how it should decide a default judgment. That statute reads, a default judgment may be rendered, not shall, may, if no issue of law or fact has been joined and the time for joining the issue has expired. The trial court considered these standards. It noted there was an issue of law and fact that had been joined. After all, there was an answer on file. The council affidavits submitted by Bowling Inc. included the position statement filed with the Department of Workforce Development. It had laid out Bowling Inc.'s argument that the severance pay should have been paid as salary continuation, not lump sum. That's the whole issue in this trial court, in the complaint. And the trial court had in front of it Bowling Inc.'s position statement to the Department of Workforce Development when Ms. Shirk herself had filed a wage claim before this trial court action was ever initiated. And it laid the whole matter out. And by the way, you'll note from the record that by the time the default judgment hearing took place, what had happened at the DWD level, the Department of Workforce Development level, they had dismissed Ms. Shirk's claim. So in terms of the injustice standards, it's certainly clear that there's a meritorious defense that had already been won, if you will, before this default judgment motion was heard, and certainly that was won later on, as Justice Babich points out, when Bowling Inc. won its summary judgment motion. The court also noted that technically the answer was late, Justice Bradley's point, by measuring the date of service on when DFI received the service as a substituted party. However, the court did also note that Bowling Inc. had filed its answer within 20 days of its receipt, which is what Bowling Inc. was directed to do under the summons upon which it was served.
Counsel, you said at the start of the argument that you felt that there were two reasons why you should prevail. First of all, that there were extraordinary circumstances, right? And secondly, was that this was excusable neglect. What precisely are the extraordinary circumstances that would allow you to avoid the time constraints of the statute?
I think the extraordinary circumstances are the method in which Bowling Inc. was served. A statute that wasn't frequently used was used. The summons form that was used was directed to Bowling Inc. and indicated upon your receipt, referring to Bowling Inc. in that second person plural, that upon your receipt of the summons, you have 20 days in, am I not speaking up loud enough? Sorry. You have 20 days in which to respond with an answer. The notice form that was used referred back then to the summons form. Those are the, and, you know, extraordinary circumstances. An answer had been filed. The issues had been joined below at the Department of Workforce Development. And Bowling Inc. technically was late by 3 or 4 days.
Okay, I'm having a difficult time distinguishing between that and excusable neglect, because if I were to ask you what would you put under excusable neglect, it seems to me you'd be putting the same things.
I think you can, and the courts have acknowledged that very point, sir.
Well,
in terms of both under 806 1A and in 1H, there seems to be quite a bit of overlap. There is a timing element, as I recall, first in a 1A excusable neglect claim versus a 1H. 1A, you are subject to a one-year time period to move for to vacate a default judgment, versus 1H, you can do it at any time.
If I may follow up, extraordinary circumstances seems, you know, should mean something. Let me advance. That it should mean something that is extraordinary. How novel. And I look at the MLB case. That's the extraordinary circumstances case, but not in the default judgment context. I mean, that's a case where you have a paternity judgment entered against a young fellow, and indeed, later on, the test results show that he could not have been the father. I mean, that seems a bit extraordinary to me, you know. That case cites two United States Supreme Court cases as illustrative of what extraordinary circumstances means. In fact, that MLB case, as I remember it, says extraordinary circumstances should be sparingly used and talks about the sanctity of the finality of judgments. So it must be important if they're talking about the sanctity. But they cite two United States Supreme Court cases, and one of those cases, maybe it was the Ackerman case, I think that dealt with deporting someone. The other case dealt, well, the one case dealt with a default judgment, and the guy was in jail, and the default was entered against him. He didn't have an attorney, and he sent a letter to the ACLU asking for an attorney, and it was confiscated by the prison guards. And so they said, well, maybe that's an extraordinary circumstance that you couldn't show up because you happened to be in jail, you didn't have money to hire an attorney, and when you tried to, the prison guards confiscated it. This is not of that kind of element, that doesn't seem. When you're talking about deportation, you're talking about a paternity that clearly was wrong in its entering.
Well, fair point. However, I think there are extraordinary circumstances when you look at the five factors that were specifically outlined in MLB, this very case that you're citing. And I would ask you to look at those factors, and I'll look at them now with you and show you how we meet each of those factors. And those are broader. I understand your point in terms of, you know, broader issues of social justice and fraternity and deportation and these broader issues. But what we had here, Justice Bradley, was a party that had been engaged in a dispute. They had been working on that issue. We actually, as the record indicates, had also been trying to negotiate elements of this dispute, which were not successful, unfortunately. So I think this is extraordinary when you think about how the lawyers conducted themselves, what issues had already been joined, and that the statute itself was odd or obscure, not followed, and has now since been repealed.
Before you walk me through the five factors of MLB, how do you address the case of Sprayer Supply versus Feeder, which says those five factors in MLB do not apply in a default judgment context?
Well, I'll have to come back to you on rebuttal on that point.
Okay. Fair enough.
The court, in terms of the five factors, Justice Bradley, the court has considered a wide range of factors which include, and then they list out five factors. And this is MLB at 552 of that decision. Whether the judgment was a result of deliberate, conscientious, and well-informed choice of the claimant. Trial court looked at this and said, no, Olenek had a reasonable interpretation of the statute. It received the summons in the form that it did. It thought it had more time. It was only 4 days late anyway. Whether the claimant received effective assistance of counsel is the second factor. The third factor is whether relief is sought from a judgment in which there has been no judicial consideration on the merits, and the interest of deciding the case on the merits outweighs the finality of judgment. This is a perfect example of that. The case had just been filed. The parties hadn't even argued anything yet. The court's resources hadn't been occupied, and then we have to go back and reopen something because somebody screwed something up in terms of filing an answer late or anything else like that. The court had hardly engaged itself in this matter. Number four, whether there's a meritorious defense. I think we've walked through those points. There's the answer. There's the DWD proceedings. There's ultimately the summary judgment victory for Bowling Inc. on this matter. And number five, whether there are intervening circumstances making it inequitable to grant relief. Here, I think we'll get back into the seldom used process method, the confusing summons, and the general preference of the courts to allow a party to have its day in court. The trial court looked at all those issues, as I've just outlined for you, and found in Bowling Inc.'s favor that the default judgment should be denied. Now, even if this court or any other court wants to insist that we have to look back at 801.15 sub 2 standards, the enlargement of time standards, which BI never motioned for, or the court wants to limit Bowling Inc.'s reopener argument to this 806.071A, the excusable neglect standard. If you're not comfortable with the 1H extraordinary circumstances and you want to pigeonhole us into the 807.1A standard, we're going to win anyway. Why? Because if you follow J.L. Phillips, Johns, and Willing, there's two prongs that we have to go through. Is there an excusable neglect for the late answer? Secondly, is there a meritorious defense? Excusable neglect, the Headkey decision, I think both parties agree, gives a good framework. How does one analyze the case? It is an abuse of discretion standard for excusable neglect. The trial court found there was this excusable neglect. You look at the record, which this court is invited to do, and look to see whether the trial court made findings of fact on the issue. I think it did. If you're not satisfied that there's actual findings of fact, then you need to go further and look at the record and draw inferences from which you can draw those factual issues. That's where the Court of Appeals erred, with all due respect to them, because they stopped right there, and they looked at the trial court's dissertation. Obviously, the trial court had read the entire record before it, because the trial court, right out of the box, hit poor Mr. Brannon with questions on his motion. So obviously, the trial court was prepared and was ready to argue the case that morning. And the record, as I've indicated, was rather extensive in terms of the affidavits and all the pleadings that were in before. So you need to look at that record, and I think the record will yield the result that there is plenty in that record for you to draw the inferences that meet this excusable neglect standard. Let me go through just a couple more technical points, if I could. We've already mentioned that the summons itself did not only indicated that Bowling Inc. had 20 days from its receipt of the summons in which to file its answer. What else about the summons?
There was a reference, though, to 181.66 in the what was mailed to you, right?
Yes. Yes. And no doubt.
That's right.
And so that reference was in, I believe it was called
on the front
notice.
Page of the summons.
It was not on the summons. It was on a notice document,
right.
And then the notice document did refer to 181, but then it also said it referred us right back to the summons.
Well, what didn't one? If you had looked at 181.66, wouldn't have that advised you that you had to a limited time to file an answer?
Maybe not. And I think that's where we get into the ambiguity of the statute itself. There was no endorsed copy sent to us. Which, as I read the statute, one is supposed to receive the endorsed copy back from the Department of Financial Institutions and then serve that on the ultimate party so that they can see that the substituted service method has been used. My time has expired.
Let me just ask you one other question. Suppose they had served this to you on, what was it, March 17th? The
St. Patrick's
Day. And the original was what, March 3 or there?
March 6th, it was filed with DFI.
So what if they had served this to you on March 27th? Would that have been okay? That would have been more than 20 days.
No, that would have violated the 181.66 standard.
So they had to file, they could have served it on 19 days, 18 days?
No, clearly not. They had to file within 10 days, and it is interesting that they waited 10 days before they filed it, so that literally this party had 10 days in which to find counsel, put in an answer, all that stuff.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Brannon.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, I am Russ Brannon. I do represent Sandra Shirk in this matter. From our point of view, this case represents a failure of meeting the burden of proof in the trial court, compounded to some extent by a trial judge who is unwilling to follow what you have repeatedly admonished trial courts to do about making a proper record and citing to the facts and the analysis that flows from it in the exercise of discretion. And it seems to me that you're being asked to engage in lots of legal gymnastics to try to salvage that situation. For example, in our view, you're being asked to take a view of the extraordinary circumstances doctrine that, frankly, seems to be at odds with the trend in the federal courts as to how they interpret their Rule 60. And, of course, our 806 statute is devoted or derived basically from that same federal rule, and you have frequently recited that the cases interpreting Rule 60 ought to be a guide to us. I'd also say that the direction that you are being asked to follow by Bowling Inc. is taking you contrary to what three cases of the Court of Appeals have viewed the application of the extraordinary circumstances doctrine, and which in my mind they are much more in conformity with where the federal courts are going. And therefore, it's the type of trend that I think both internally and externally you ought to be guided by, and it is away from the direction that you're being taken by Bowling Inc. I also think you're being asked to discard or ignore about 4 to 5 different precepts of longstanding that acts as guides to the trial court and appellate court and how they review records and how they administer motions and requests for relief of this sort. I think at the bottom line, we have an issue here where there is an insufficient record. And while there is much argument that was made in front of the trial court, and while there was a submission of argument, to this day, we still don't know who did what, where, when, and how, and in reliance on what, and at what time there was such reliance that caused an answer not to be filed. Now, the problem is when you don't make a record, there's a lot of freedom to take some liberties with the way the inferences can be derived. A short example is in this reply brief. There is this interesting timeline that is provided hypothetically to lead you to the conclusion that the summons and complaint here actually were served on March 19th. Well, of course, someone has already pointed out that it is plain in the record that it was admitted by counsel for Bowling, Inc., that in fact he had the summons and complaint on March 17th, presumably having received it from his client because it was mailed to his client the day before. And of course, we also see in the record that same day a mailing occurs to the trial court and the trial court gets the summons and complaint with the proof of service, file stamps it March 17th. So you have to ask yourself, what purpose is being served on a reply brief by a hypothetical to take us away from what the facts of record are, what limited facts there are?
On the facts of record, my limited understanding of them is that you served a summons on the Department of whatever it is.
Financial institutions.
Financial institutions. Now, does the statute require them to then serve a copy of that upon Bowling?
No, Your Honor, and that's why I'm totally nonplussed by this argument of an endorsed copy coming from the Department of Financial Institutions. Now, that is true. That's what happens from the Commissioner of Insurance, but that's not in the statute in front of us.
So there is no obligation on the part of the financial services to serve or to even send a copy?
Correct. What they do is they issue a certificate, and that's what's mentioned in the statute. And it is our obligation within 10 days to have a copy of the pleading and the department's certificate served by mail on the defendant in this case. And that was done, and there's never been any challenge that we did not conform with that statute. And in the record is a copy of their certificate, our notice explaining that you have been served. You have been served as of the date of March 6th. I don't know how you can be much more plain than that. We do reference the summons.
What does that certificate say?
The certificate identifies that the department has been served with a copy of the summons and complaint as of that date and directs the recipient to look at 181.66.2. That is,
and that's the one that says that. Is there anything in there, in that certificate or what you served then on Bowling, to alert them that there is some other timeline that's at play here other than the normal 20 days from the time of that you received the service, the summons and complaint?
No, Your Honor, and you've raised a very good point. The time for answer and the time for divining where service has occurred is done in a separate statute, 801.13, that is universal. And it says if you serve substituted service on an agent for a party, and there are corporate agents, there are the various departments of the state of Wisconsin that are appointed as substituted service agents, service has been complete as of that date. I frankly don't understand, if there was a lawyer involved in this process, why you're looking at those statutes, because the time to answer and the definition of which service is to occur universally is covered in our rules of civil procedure.
Well, counsel, maybe it's covered in the rules of civil procedure, and I think that it is, but I look at the document before me, and let me say the documents. One is the notice that you made reference to, which is on page 43 of the appendix. And sure enough, just like you say, it says, take notice that a copy of the authenticated summons and complaint was served upon you through the aforesaid department.
all pursuant to WIS Stats 181662. The next sentence says, reference is herewith made to the contents of the appended summons for further instructions. So I say, okay, let me look at that summons for further instructions. And lo and behold, it says, within 20 days of receiving this summons. So someone gives me this summons, or my client, and this summons says, within 20 days of receiving this summons, you must respond with a written answer. And that summons, then in its last paragraph, goes on to say, now if you don't provide a proper answer within 20 days, the court may grant judgment against you, essentially a default judgment. So while the rules of civil procedure may be clear, it's advanced that the summons is confusing.
I'd like to respond to that in a number of levels. And the first level is we don't know who has formed this particular conjunction of analysis and when they did it. Number two, the courts of appeals in Gruth versus American Star Insurance looked at this identical issue and said, we're not going to buy the fact that an insurance company under the comparable provisions of a substituted service there can evade the time for answer by looking at our statutory user-friendly summons and claim to be confused.
But
you are in business, you must follow the business statutes.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say there's this hypothetical statute that says you can serve process on the defendant by serving the attorney general. And then the statute goes on to say, and within 14 days, the attorney general of receipt, the attorney general has to endorse the copy and return it to you, the plaintiff. And then the plaintiff has 18 days from that time to serve. Now, those times are not important. In that kind of a hypothetical statute, do you think the standard summons, which says within 20 days of receiving the summons, you must respond with an answer, is the appropriate summons to use?
The problem, Your Honor, is that we're not rewriting summonses out on the field in the moment of service. We commence the action by filing the summons and complaint together.
Well,
and they're authenticated.
Why don't you, you're the plaintiff, this is your summons. Why don't you have a summons, if you're going to employ 181, and you have every right to employ 181, why don't you use a summons that is consistent with 181 rather than inconsistent with 181?
The summons we used is the statutory form summons. I think we are loath if we start rewriting the summonses, because I think we're going to get the argument that any redraft we take takes us away from what has been an approved and sanctioned form.
So it's your position, even if the terms of the standard summons are inconsistent with the law upon which you have made service, you should still use the standard summons?
Your Honor, what we do is make it pointedly clear in the accompanying notice when the time for service has occurred. That's how we deal with the problem. The summons remains the same, but you'll notice, and I think you just read it to us all, the notice and explanation definitely told them when service occurred. So there couldn't be any confusion.
That's on the 6th, according to that notice.
Point blank, you have been served on the 6th. That's how you cure the problem. You can't rewrite the summons in the field. The process server, being unable to find a person and having to do substituted service, doesn't rewrite the summons.
Okay.
But you employ an explanatory.
The summons says within 20 days of receiving the summons, you must respond. It doesn't say within 20 days of service upon you.
Your Honor, this is a business. This is not an individual. It's obliged, as I think the Court of Appeals reflected, to understand the rules of the road. We're not dealing with an unsophisticated minor who's getting served.
Well,
there is two different documents are directing it right to the statute. There's this interesting suggestion in the affidavits, and that's carried farther in the argument in the brief, that the defendant couldn't get guidance from the Department of Financial Institutions about how to answer that. But the suggestion seems to be that they're first calling the department on this whole issue after they're getting notice of the default judgment. I think it's an interesting hypothetical, but I have yet to see who is relying on it and when they formed this reliance.
It seems to me your response should be that the summons receipt is equivalent to service.
The summons form you use, counsel, if I could jump in here, and I think this goes to the question that you asked, is the summons form that's used when there is personal service, right?
Yes.
Why didn't you use the summons form when there is no personal service?
Because at the time when we first filed the action, we weren't sure how we were going about to effect service. And it seems to me that we've cured that problem by that explanatory notice that made it definitely clear when they were served. It seems to me you have to wade past that to create the issue of confusion, being pointed to the very statute that explains that you have been served.
I guess what, and we're looking, I asked opposing counsel on the quote, obscure statute, which he answered. Just looking at the facts here, you were dealing with basically local counsel. I mean, you were dealing because, according to what I read in the appendix, you had these letters going back and forth. And opposing counsel made the argument, well, to this court, that it was just a few weeks afterward in this statute, 181-66, was repealed. It was no longer on the books. What is confusing to me, and I'm listening to the questions of my colleagues, that Justice Sykes or Justice Bradley, Chief Justice Abramson, on your use of the regular, what we call the 20-day summons, which it seems to me, because you were dealing previously, you knew what you knew about the foreign corporation, you knew who you were dealing with, that to use the regular summons, it just made it confusing. Now, I'm just not trying to beg the question, but your answer seems to be that you didn't want to change things in the field, but in the field, you knew who you were dealing with. You were dealing with Bowling Inc. You were dealing with the certain law firm that's here today. And to use this kind of, I'm not going to buy the word obscure, but to use this method, but then to use also the regular summons, you don't think that caused confusion?
Not with the notice that we appended right to it that explained that they were served on March 6th through the department. I don't know how we could have been much plainer by doing it that way. And first document you have to go through tells you have been served on March 6th.
Counsel, 801.095 deals with summons forms, and it states, the summons shall be substantially in one of the forms specified through sub 1 to 4, and there are four different forms that you can use. The statute goes on to read, the applicable form depends on the type of service and whether a complaint is served with the summons in accord with 80109, and 80109 says what has to be in a summons, that is, the title of the cause and where you serve a copy of the answer, that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you're not bound, you're not taking the position that you're bound to use the standard service form in view of the language in 801.095 that the applicable form depends on the type of service?
I think if you move away from the language in those forms, you do so at your peril. To me, it's much clearer to rely on the certificate from the department and directly point out, this is what the certificate means, you have been served. To me, that is the clearest way of expressing what has happened. You can't ignore it, it's right in front of you. And again, this is a business that is governed by this statute. And let me address this idea of obscurity for a moment. This statute may have been obscure as far as the Department of Financial Institutions is concerned, but that's simply because a few years before, this whole function had been shifted from the Secretary of State to that department. Historically, we've had the same statute before the Secretary of State, before that office was, shall we say, remodeled and many of its functions taken away. So certainly for DFI, they may have not had a lot of experience, but service on foreign corporations generally through the Secretary of State has always been, or for a long time, has followed this exact method. So obscure to DFI, but not obscure to the general public and to the lawyers, because it's been in our books for quite a long time.
Don't you think it's arguable, counsel, that under the statute, excuse me, that Justice Bradley just read from, you were required to use the alternate form of summons since you were using a non-personal service form of service?
Your Honor, there's nothing that ties that two together, and we often have attempts at personal service where you can't obtain the person, and then you have to resort to substitute service. You don't have to go back and refile. You don't rewrite the summons in the field.
Was this that sort of a situation? Did you attempt personal service and then fail, and so you used the substitute service?
Instead, we made it very clear by using a notice to direct that.
Okay.
And I guess all I can say is the same issue. The Court of Appeals has been unimpressed with the idea that you could be misled by the summons saying that in that user-friendly format. And I think that's a very wise decision that a business, a party that's in business that is governed by a certain statute ought to be familiar with the rules of the road for operating in our state. It seems to me you can't make it any clearer, and we've achieved the substantive effect. What was, by using the statutory form summons, by the notice that we put in as plain language as we could make it, you are served on this date of March 6th.
Except the user-friendly format of summons for substituted service reads differently than the user-friendly format for personal service, does it not?
Same issue before Girth, Your Honor. It was the same personal service statute that was attempted to have a user-friendly form of the summons that was served through the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance, where your Court of Appeals has rejected that as being excusable neglect. And I think to be consistent, again, I'm having a difficult time seeing how a person could have been misled come the first time and tells them on this day.
But the court, what I am, or straight, what the question I'm driving at, or, you know, you already knew, you knew. You had local counsel. According to the appendix, there were letters flying back and forth. So that's what I think the gist of these questions are, to go from what we call the ordinary and regular under 801.095 to using this other type of service is what I think is the question.
I think, Your Honor, there certainly was contact that had preceded this issue, but I don't think you're going to find that there was any contact current with the filing of this complaint. There had been an exchange of some correspondence earlier, but this is not something where we are in daily communication on how this happened. I think the appropriate method is what we did, is to explain point blank, you're served.
Counsel, I think there was correspondence right after. I mean, I would have to look it up in the appendix, but I recall within a couple of days after the 6th of March, there was a letter.
It's correspondence from the defendant to the Department of Workforce Development, Your Honor, not us.
Counsel, I have a question of procedure here. You served the summons and complaint on the department on March 6th, and that started the time clock ticking. Then on March 16th, you served this notice of service, and so therefore they only had 10 days to get out an answer.
Right.
What if you had waited until March 25th to get out this notice of service, or could you have?
Could not. There is a 10-day time frame.
There is a 10-day time frame. Okay.
So there did. I think there was a hypothetical, what if you waited 24 days, 25 right. days? That's invalid service.
Okay.
Pretty plain under 18166.
Let me follow up on another procedural question, and that is, here we have arguably the time running, and as I recall, an answer was filed in this case, is it on the 3rd of the month? April 3rd. Maybe it was the 1st. First, let me see right here. The answer was filed on April 1st. The hearing was on April 6th. Now, isn't there a requirement that if there is an answer filed, albeit late, that in order for you to get a default judgment, that you have to strike the answer?
Your Honor, and I think the record records, our motion had already been pending before that. It was filed on the 30th, certainly preceding any filing of the answer. And frankly, through some oversight, I never received the copy of the answer until afterwards. It had been filed with the court, but I was standing there that morning unaware that there had been a filing.
And that's understandable, and I read that part of the record, you know, that you wouldn't have it in your written motion because it hadn't yet been filed, and lo and behold, you didn't even have a copy of it. But apparently it was filed on April 1. The hearing was on April 6th. It intrigues me. So what does a court do when you have an answer that has been filed, albeit late? Can you enter a default judgment without striking the answer if an answer actually has been filed?
That's what the court, we feel, should have done. On the basis of our motion is grant the default judgment and in that process strike the answer. And the standards all seem to be the same. Whether you deal, as counsel has noted, under 80601 or otherwise, that it's an excusable neglect standard, you're never relieved of demonstrating excusable neglect.
Mm-hmm. And but I want to stay on this procedure sure. this, with regard to striking the answer. You never requested the answer to be struck. Can a default judgment was not entered, but your argument is that it should have been entered. Can a default judgment be entered without striking an answer? And if not, why didn't you ask that the answer be struck once you found out there was one?
The court was already in the process of denying my motion at that point, so it's somewhat of an exercise in futility. It was already denying it before I even know there was an answer filed. I should say about 2 minutes after I learned that there was an answer filed, he was in the process of denying the motion. So it seems somewhat of an exercise in futility. I think the court was clear it was not going to grant that relief. I think that's superfluous. Still, I come back to the fact that the burden of proof always is on the party seeking to evade the default to show excusable neglect. And there isn't any showing here. This is simply a nice hypothetical argument that is not tied to any person at any point in time. And repeatedly, you have admonished trial courts not to accept a superficial explanation, to scrutinize the record, to compel and test what is being said to you. And that just didn't happen, because there is no record. There are simply arguments of counsel on a hypothetical. We know of no one who actually was subjected to this process of being allegedly misled by an obscure statute and by a summons that may have misled them. The problem, I think, in remand, if I could address that, is that it's appropriate to have remand if there are facts of record and the trial court simply has ignored them, or if there are issues of record that the trial court has ignored. But what Bowling Inc. is saying is remand so we can create a record in the first instance. That's a failure of a burden of proof. And historically, you have always said, if you don't put your evidence in, the simple fact is you're not entitled to relief. And we don't remand to give you another kick at the cat to go put the evidence in.
Was that done in Headke? I forget what the nature of the remand that was in Headke, but it sticks in my head that maybe in
Headke... It was to reconsider what was there. It was to reconsider what was before the trial court, not to take new testimony.
Yes, but to make new findings of fact consistent with what it perceived to be in the record.
And that's not what's being asked here. The remand is to go back to create a record, not for the judge to study the findings of fact, but to allow testimony to be taken. Because, again, we don't, as we sit here today, I don't know who formulated this concept that they were being misled when having received the summons, as I should say, and summons and complaint on March 17th, And as counsel has acknowledged, on March 9th, they virtually had completed their investigation of the same issues that were in this complaint and wrote a letter to the Department of Workforce Development laying out their response. So to me, it's not a matter of inability to answer. Before they were even served with the complaint, they had completed the review of all of these claims, formed their answer. It would have been a very simple exercise, simply to take that information, cast it into an answer, and file it to the trial court and with counsel. What I am suggesting, where you're being taken on this extraordinary circumstances jaunt, and where I think the Court of Appeals have taken you away, and I think, Justice Bradley, you well know what was said in Sprayer, that many of the instances you've recounted in MLB simply are going to be there for any default judgment case. Now, Professor Moore, in his Moore's Federal Practice, says that the trend in the federal courts is to withhold exceptional circumstances grants when there is culpable conduct, which he equates with inexcusable neglect. That you shouldn't, I think as you pointed out, come into the court and ask for extraordinary relief if you've had excusable neglect. The rare instances, and I think the Johns case is one of those, and I think MLB is one of those, is where the imposition of the judgment is so out of character that it creates controversy between a settled decision, a prior settled judgment, that is going to cause a spate of litigation to try to resolve those two mutually inconsistent decisions. That's the type of extraordinary result that you can be forgiving for an underlying excusable neglect. And that just is not the case here. There's nothing extraordinary about this case in terms of the circumstances. This is just a simple default case. What, frankly, most of the, Your Honor?
What a good public policy is served by rigorously enforcing the 10-day period that Bowling had in this case?
Your Honor, the same factors, even while the courts of the past have recited judicial distaste, they also come back and say, but we have to superintend the response periods and getting things done in a timely fashion. Frankly, Your Honor, people will come looking for lawyers all the time and say, I've been served with a lawsuit 2 weeks ago and I need someone to represent me. Lawyers react on limited terms to either file an answer, file a motion for an extension of time, or arrange for an extension of time. It is now plainly admitted that they had 9 days to do any of these things after having fully explored and responded in writing to the very same issues. This is not a case, and to their credit, they're not claiming that they were unable to answer, that they were somehow put in a position not being able to develop an answer. Simply, they didn't answer, they didn't seek an extension of time, they didn't request an extension of time. My suggestion is that all comes back to the same philosophy in Headkey and Hansher, that there are competing issues here, not just distaste for default judgment, but the need to have some excusable reason for why that default occurred. And frankly, if there was an excusable reason, if it was legitimate that somebody was ill, papers had been lost in an excusable fashion, that makes sense. But what we're confronted with is an argument that is unrelated in time and place and person. It is a hypothetical argument.
Counsel, if I could, I'm still back on this issue about the summons, and not whether or not it was confusing, giving rise to an argument of excusable neglect, but whether, in fact, it was faulty. And I keep looking at the language of 801.095, which says the summons shall be substantially in one of the forms specified in subparagraphs 1 to 4, and the applicable form depends upon the type of service. And the language of the summons that is to be used in a case where there is no personal service is different than the language of the form summons where there is personal service, which is the one that you used. And reading that in conjunction with 801.09, which precedes it, and which pertains to the contents, the required contents of the summons, 801.09 sub 2A says that the contents of the summons must include the statement that within 45 days, it used to be 20, exclusive of the day of service, after the summons has been served personally upon the defendant or served by substitution personally upon another authorized to accept the service of the summons for the defendant. That reading those two in conjunction with one another seems to me to at least arguably lead to the conclusion that you used the wrong summons, it was faulty, and we don't even get to any of these other issues. Do you have a response to that?
Sure, Your Honor. My time is run, but if I may continue the response. The fact is, Your Honor, what you asked for in the substituted service language is right there in the cover sheet that identifies that they have been served by a substituted service on this date.
Why didn't you just put it in your summons? In an excess and abundance of caution.
It would have been a good idea, but I think we did what, to my mind, somebody had to search to find this argument by looking in the summons. When the plain first document out of the box tells them you're served on March 6th.
So your argument is that your notice under 181 does the job
with a certificate. With a certificate from the Department of Financial Institutions. I mean, you've got a document under seal that tells them you have been served.
The problem with that, counsel, is that there's a different number of dates if I'm looking at the right statute, too, and I'm looking at 95-96. If there's no personal service and complaint is served at the same time, it's a 40-day time period under sub 3. Whereas you're filing under sub 1, personal service complaint attached, it's a 20-day time period. I think that's the problem. Am I looking at the wrong statutes? That's my first issue.
Substituted service is still the 20-day time frame at that time, Your Honor.
Well, that's why I prefaced what statute I'm looking at, and I'm looking at 95-96. And there it was different. What statute do you think I should be looking at?
I think that's the appropriate year, but I'm...
Well, it just says no personal service, complaint served at the same time. That's sub 3. It says you're notified that the plaintiff above is filed. Within 40 days after, and you're supposed to put in a date, you must respond with an answer. Number 1, which is the personal service complaint attached, it says within... Paren 20, paren 45, and we would be under paren 20, you must respond with a written answer. So if you follow through on this, you got an issue of the number of days. The other question.
I think you're looking at it where it informs them the right for this right for the complaint that's not served at the same time.
No, complaint. 3 says complaint served at the same time. 4 says no personal service, complaint not served, and that's 40 days too. So that's my first question. My second question is, I thought you were going to argue that 181-66 is not a substituted service, that it is a personal service. That it's a special kind of statute, that it's personal service, therefore it comes under 1. You willing to argue that?
That does appear to be how it reads, Your Honor, and that's why we follow it, because and when you go back to 801.13, that's the statute that says here's the time within when it's been served in that fashion on an appointed agent. You have been served as of the act of service on the agent, not in some later date as is being argued here. So that's what we're looking at in terms of how service is defined and where you count the time frame. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I have 5 minutes and about 4 points. The first point I wanted to make is to follow up on Justice Bradley's question on sprayer supply. There, Sprayer, which was a court of appeals, said that the MLB case outlining those extraordinary circumstances issues should not be followed because MLB was not a default judgment case, so don't use those standards. I think that's wrong. First off, it's a court of appeals decision, so you're not bound by it. Secondly, there's no authority cited for that remarkable proposition that the court of appeals took. And thirdly, I think it carves out the statutory language in a way that's inappropriate. The statute, 80607, says, refers to judgments and orders. It doesn't carve out default judgments in asking how you should apply the standard.
This is important to me, and that's why I asked it. The court in Sprayer says, number one, just like you say, MLB was not a default case, okay? It goes on to say the MLB, and this is at the very last page of the decision, MLB factors are simply not relevant to whether extraordinary circumstances exist as to default judgment. And this is why, they say, because some or all of the listed factors are present in almost every default judgment situation. And indeed, that's true. As I read the factors, their final or next to final paragraph, their conclusion is, in this opinion, were we to hold that a circuit court's failure to consider the MLB factors in determining whether to set aside a default judgment constitutes an abuse of discretion, we would be opening up the doors to a flood of litigation, much of it meritless, to set aside aged default judgments. And the reason is, they say, or I said in preceding paragraphs, is because those factors apply in almost all summary judgment, default judgment, rather, cases. One of the factors, whether the judgment was the result of conscientious, deliberate, and well-informed choice of the claimant. Well, there's no default judgment that meets that test. Whether the claimant received effective assistance of counsel. Well, the lawyer was late in filing, or the party didn't even give it to a lawyer. Most default judgments wouldn't even, you know, these apply to all default judgments, as the Sprayer case said, or I guess they said almost every default judgment. So how do you deal with that?
Thank you for the question. I think you deal with it because in saying that Sprayer is just respectfully, wrongly decided. I think they carved out something from the statute that's not there. The statute does not carve out default judgments from a listing of those factors and then the courts that have interpreted those factors over the years. And I would respectfully disagree with that Court of Appeals when they say that all of those factors are going to be present in every default judgment case.
Well, almost every.
But not all parties are conscientious and deliberate in filing their answers. Some of these default judgment cases that are in the record, or you know, that the courts have decided, you've got people waiting months before they ever file an answer and things of that sort. So I just respectfully disagree with that carve-out that the court has done.
So we'd have to overrule Sprayer in order to apply MLB factors in this case?
I think you would, yeah. If you want to involve all those MLB factors which get to extraordinary circumstances. If you don't want to take that route and you just want to decide it on excusable neglect, then you don't have to do that. Set it at 4 points. The Girth case was mentioned several times by opposing counsel, and he said that the court has already said that you can't change the 80109 summons form. You can't change it in the field. The court's already decided that. That's not what Girth said. And we cite to the Girth decision on page 5 of our reply brief, and there it was a commissioner of insurance case. The commissioner of insurance mailed out a summons complaint form. It wasn't a summons complaint form created by the plaintiff. It was a form that was sent out by the commissioner of insurance. And there's no mention in that case about you should or should not use the 801095 summons form. I'm intrigued by some of these later questions in terms of the 80195 sub 3 form. Unfortunately, I don't have my 9596 statute, so I don't really feel prepared to address those issues, but it does seem like there is an issue. I would point out the inconsistency that if counsel believes that he is mandated to use a particular summons form, then he could have used that summons form, which would appear to have been closer to correct. Lastly, I'm a Roman Catholic, so I'll use the term sin, but you know, what sin has Bullying Inc. committed here? Their sin is that they misread a statute and they're off by a couple of days on their answer. What prejudice has befallen Shirk. Notably, she is silent on that issue. She's never claimed how this 3 or 4 day delay has prejudiced her in any way. And lastly, to follow up on Justice Wilcox's question, you were right, Justice Wilcox. There was a letter. It was from me. It was sent to opposing counsel. It was March 5th, the day after the original filing had taken place in the circuit court, at least, where I had been encouraged in a prior letter to read one of my letters backwards. And I advised that I didn't think that rhetoric was very constructive to Mr. Brannon, and I again asked him to contact me to explore settlement. So clearly, we were trying to work this out and not be here today. That unfortunately didn't work out. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, both Mr. Bextel and Mr. Brannon. That